Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors for you this week. Lynda.com, LYNDA.com/shoptalk. If you go to that URL, you'll get a 7-day free trial for their huge learning resource on lots of different stuff. We'll talk about that more later in the show. And Environments for Humans, who are having another in-person Artifact Conf, because that one has been so awesome and going so well. That's at ArtifactConf.com, May 5th through 7th in Austin, Texas. We'll tell you more about actually both of those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, the web's premier fashion advice podcast. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. We have a very special show. Thanks for listening. It's special because it's one of the classics. It's a
rapid fire episode.
It is. It's our 23rd rapid fire show. We number them for some reason. It's nice to be able to identify it specifically, I guess. I guess that's why you number anything. Episode 102, Rapid Fire 23. That's the name of the show. And like all Rapid Fires, we have no guests, no news, no drama. We're just going to answer as many listener questions as we can because we actually have kind of a backlog as usual. So we're kind of actually went back a little back in time on this one and tried to pick back some of the older ones because we, you know, like to get to it
deep absolutely into the mail bin.
And we're going to try to do the timer thing again, you know, where we did 3 minutes for every question. We are going to do that. And
but we have a new rule. We have a new rule.
Oh, that's
which
right.
Is,
tell us what that is.
Each of us have a card, a physical card. We've paid a lot of money for them. And we can put our, it's an extender card. And if you want to keep talking about a subject, you can throw your extender card. But we each only have one. So otherwise, we can't extend. So
that's right. We can go over the 3 minutes if we feel like we have something important to say here. Otherwise, cut off at 3 seconds. I'm not going to use my iPhone this time. I actually timer-tab.com is actually like a pretty nice little online timer thingy. So I'm going to try to use that. I doubt that it makes sound, and I would mute it anyway. So I'm going to have to make some kind of visual or audio cue.
Sweet.
So maybe one will just emerge, but I'll click the button as soon as we're done reading the question.
So the first question is actually not a question. It's more of an opinion from Wesley Terry. Writes in, HTML email is super fun to design for, so I'm a little surprised that you guys aren't all about it and kind of put it down in show number 12, long
way
time
back
ago. The demographic I designed for love their email, and I'm sure they will until they retire. Obviously older crowd, but still relevant. It's kind of what they've known for decades and how they communicate. I might argue that point, but let's keep going. Responsive design is also working its way into HTML email. So it's just one more way to keep the skills of people with coding knowledge more relevant in the workplace. Some PR guru with a Twitter account can't really compete with those skills. So should we?
Yeah, let's do this one. Go.
Okay.
Go.
So thanks, Wesley, for writing in. And yes, we do kind of put down HTML email a lot on the show. We apologize.
It's mostly from a tech perspective, right? Like kind of like it sucks to work with because it's so hard and it feels old school and stuff. It's mostly from that perspective.
It's like the most difficult aspect of web design, and I just don't want to do it. And there's questions like, do HTML emails provide value? But you're saying you have an older demographic who's maybe used to like direct mailers looking really pretty. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense. I mean, sure. I think everyone who sends an HTML email has a reason, you know.
And the fact that you like it is awesome, and I would never take that away from you. I mean, if you are excited about it and get good return on it and like working on it, I would hate to don't let us rain on your parade.
Yeah, yeah, we're scumbags. And it's great we have your email address now. But, you know, I mean, this is the kind of work I would live to hand off to a team that just knows how to do this. And we've done that in the past at Paravel. Just like, you know, if you want a really good one, you want to talk to these guys, you know? So that's something. So I totally agree with the PR guru. Like, you know, some dude who writes like a newsletter or whatever isn't as good as a team of people with HTML chops. So.
Line felt weird to me too. It was like, okay, well, just because you know how to do HTML email doesn't make you good at PR. And just because there's a PR person out there who uses Twitter and doesn't know how to make an HTML email doesn't mean they're bad at PR. I mean, that was just a weird jab. I feel like,
maybe that's there's some hot drama between HTML email and PR gurus.
Possibly.
HTML email gurus versus PR gurus. Looking forward to this in 2014.
I'm a big fan of using the services, as I've said before, just because I feel like they have really good, nice-looking templates. The services, meaning Campaign Monitor, MailChimp, whatever. We could
always, yes.
And they just turn out really good and have good deliverability and stuff. But I'm a big fan of not using HTML email when it's just a simple message. And, you know, just from anecdotal evidence of I prefer that. But I know you do got to look at analytics and that kind of thing. Anyway, maybe let's move on with this one, huh?
All right.
Alex Yoshido writes in, I do web development as a freelancer, and I can usually take on any task given to me by a project. My question is, how do you know when to scale up and to get bigger clients and start charging more? Do I need to look like an agency? Do I need a team? What do we think?
This is a good question.
So
I think that you don't need any of those things. I think there are a lot of people who are successful without doing that. But I will say web development and websites are better with friends, you know? So even if you have a small team, it's awesome. I mean, my company Paravel, we really like working together. We work with big clients. We graft into their teams more or less. And you know, so that's something you can do. I would say, so he says how to scale up, get bigger clients and start charging more. I mean, you can start charging more today. Actually, you can up your rate and maybe not get a client. And, that's one thing that bums me out is somebody's like, you know, if somebody's like, oh man, I want that apartment, but it's like $200 more a month. I'm like, you know, if you raised your rate $5, you could probably afford that over 40 hours, you know, so that's just it. You know, it's kind of like, I think you can start charging more. I don't know. I don't think you need to look like an agency. But I would say careful scaling up because, that's more overhead. So that's more money you have to clear. So, don't overscale. Chris?
Yeah, I think Alex is writing in probably because he wants to scale up and get bigger. But I am putting those words in his mouth a little bit because he really says, how do you know when to scale up? And Alex, I think there's probably two ways to do that. Like if you want to, then you should, you know, like if you're like, I really want to get bigger, well, then think of some ways to do it. And we can talk about that for a minute. And then the other one is just that there's so much work pouring in or projects that are of such scale that you can't do them by yourself. That would be a good time too. So if you want this and that's happening, then you should definitely scale up. I know what you mean about looking like an agency. That's a little weird. So I don't know. We've talked about this in previous shows too. Do you have a website that looks like, you know, your design? I don't know. You have some fancy name, like a logo that's like a zebra or something. So you
have a New York office and a San Francisco office, but that San Francisco office is actually your mom's timeshare, you know?
Yeah. Will that actually help? I think honesty is the best policy there, as we've talked about before. I think you should clearly represent who and what is on a particular team. Any final thoughts there, Dave?
I was going to say, good people to talk to, Bizcraft, Carl Smith, and Gene Crawford, they're awesome guys. And Ben Callahan from Sparkbox, he kind of has a pretty big team that's kind of scaled up. So I've talked to him in the past. He's got some pretty good stories. So reach out to those people. They know things.
Well, I hope that if you want to grow, you're able to, Alex. All right. Kaboom.
Next question. Brom Dahan writes in my mind, CMSs are too often an annoying, unnecessary layer between the developer, designer, and the code, making it harder instead of easier to optimize and maintain. While I see the need for them in e-commerce and blogs, I just wish one could have a setup that could bypass the CMS and database more easily.
Click.
So just, okay, so he's kind of saying like, how, you know, how can I bypass all the CMS and all the PHP?
What do you think he's really feeling here? What is Bram's like actually feeling?
I think his use case is a five pager, like, you know, about contact services, right, homepage, you know, like a five pager that,
and now instead
really
of just knocking that out, he's got to install this big software, there's thousands WordPress of files, I got to worry about security, I have to use
templates,
MySQL to have a thing, yeah, right,
yeah,
I can feel you there. So what would be an alternative to that?
I mean, my love is these new static site generators, and but that's a lot harder to hand off, you know, because you're handing off a like thing that only you know how to do, and then
yeah,
Jekyll gonna
you can't tell your
WordPress
nerd to just open their terminal and type, you know, gulp build site whatever. That's just it's just not happening. And maybe there can be some UI built around them someday or whatever. But yeah, certainly, Bram, look into static site generators, because it does allow you to do just that and is bypass the CMS and database kind of, and you can, I mean, you know, a static site generator is a CMS of some kinds. It just, it literally doesn't use a database and uses kind of backend code to build those things anyway, but it still has the concept of a template, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's still kind of good because you get the benefit from that. And then there's so many situations in the world where bypassing a CMS is just kind of dumb. I mean, CMS and database isn't just like stuff to get in your way. It's a way to store and use structured data. So as you said, you could see the need for them in e-commerce and blogs. I'm sure you can extend your thinking there to know that like any kind of structured data is important here. I mean, think of a real estate website or whatever else. There's the title of the property, the location, the minimum price, the maximum price, the pictures that you associated with it, the description of the house, the map coordinates. There's all this structured data. If you were to build all that stuff into just an HTML file and just build out your entire site that way, you're going to regret that. You're going to regret that you didn't store the data in a special place just for data.
Maintenance nightmare.
Right. I mean that's not acceptable, you know.
Yeah, like if you have to add a link tag to a list of houses, oh man, the herd is on. So so I would avoid that. I would also just, if you think your client is going to eventually want some dynamic stuff, like, you know, I just met these guys, but I think they're going to want to like have a newsletter thing. It's helpful. But one thing you can do with WordPress, which, I mean, consider this, you can, in your theme, you know, you can just make your static pages. You can do page-about.php and then just code an about page. Like, okay.
Hilarious. This is really funny UI, how this timer tab thing works. Are you using your card or not?
I don't think so. I hope I got to where I was getting.
You did. You did.
That
you did.
Sense. Okay, cool. All right. Next up, we got
a sponsor.
A little bit of a sponsor.
Yeah, so lynda.com, lynda.com, is this huge online learning resource. And I should say /stoptalk. Put that at the end of it, not only just for us, because that would be useful to know that we have people that listen to our show that like us enough to go to URLs that we tell them to go to. But that if you sign up through that... we could have a whole show about that, I figure out. It's kind of like there's no good, great analytics for this kind of thing. How does lynda.com know that this is worth their sponsorship dollars? Anyway, it is worth it because
nailed it.
You get your 7-day free trial if you sign up through there, and that gives you kind of full access to explore their entire library, which is absolutely enormous. You know, there's new courses every day on lynda.com, thousands of courses. It's crazy. I like to just list off some of the current week because that makes the ad kind of fresh and it's kind of interesting. So of course they have, like, if you just like want to learn webby stuff, like all the type of stuff we talked about, there's for sure a course on it on lynda.com somewhere. But then there's all this kind of specific stuff. There's a course this week on building confidence, like just becoming a better person through that. So kind of even some kind of self-help stuff, which I find is interesting. There's a class, design the web from Illustrator to HTML5 Canvas. So wow, that would be fascinating to me to figure out how those two things are interrelated. Sculpting and painting a head in Cinema 4D. So if you're looking to make the move into, I don't know, the movie world and in 3D stuff, modeling, that there's stuff like that on there. Tethered shooting fundamentals, which is when you have like a nice DSLR camera and you hook it up to like an iPad or a laptop to give you that like extra information in that big screen. It's like how that stuff works, which is cool. I've actually done a little bit of that before. There's an iPhone app that I've got paired to my phone. So I can kind of set it up on a tripod and then like stand in front of it and control the camera from my phone in front of it. It's cool. I don't know if they cover that. I'll have to show you. It's nice because then you can trigger the clicking of the photo from not behind the camera, right? So if you want to like, you know, be adjusting stuff in your little scene and then just tap your phone to take the picture. I'm sure it's, that type of stuff is covered in there. Anyway, it starts at like $25 a month on lynda.com if you decide to like it. So anyway.
Awesome.
Thank you for the sponsorship. Yeah, what?
7 days free. Free college, kids.
Yeah, you don't need a code there or anything. You just use that URL. Gabriel Luce. I think it's a minute or so audio
here. One. Yeah. All right, let me cue it up in the old Q-O-Matron. Here we go.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my question. Surprise, I've got a question about responsive design. You know, doesn't everybody? But anyway, what are your thoughts on the differences between the whole flexible grid, flexible images approach and the approach of having multiple fixed width layouts triggered by media queries? I feel like the flexible grid way is considered, you know, true responsive design, and the multiple fixed width layout approach is maybe frowned upon as not being really responsive. But I kind of feel like the fixed width layout way is, you know, works for me better, maybe because it's a little easier. Maybe I'm being lazy. I don't know. But I feel like it gives me more control or however things are going to look. I know the flexible route is pretty simple for simple designs, but my designs tend to get kind of complex, and having everything fluid seems really hard most of the time. Maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe I need to rethink my workflow. What do you guys think?
All right, Gabriel, thanks for writing in. And that question could have been a little old, but I'm glad we're talking about it. Chris,
I find it still a little bit relevant. So we're comparing two things. We're comparing that fluid grids thing, and that every, you know, maybe every grid thing is a percentage. So as you expand and contract your browser window, or, you know, more importantly, open the thing on different devices with them where the maximum browser width is what it is. It fits into exactly that space. You know, it stretches pixel by pixel, right? And then we're comparing that against like, I'm going to design one version of the site that works at 1200 pixels. Then I'm going to design, you know, then I'm going to say, its actual straight up, its width is 1200, and then make a media query and its width becomes 1,000 pixels. So it's more like adaptive design, I feel like. Didn't we end up calling that one?
That's the word, and there's blog posts about it. Yeah.
Sure, and the control is higher there would be true, mm-hmm. right? Like if I put something there, it's expected to just, it's just gonna be there. Whereas like in a totally fluid place, well, when it's at 1100 pixels, then it's kind of in between those two. And it's just a different world thinking of completely fluid websites and ones that where there's just a number of flexed ones. And Gabriel says he's just kind of more comfortable with that multiple fixed layouts kind of situation. And to that, I would say, awesome. You know, if that's your style, and that's just the way that you like to do it, I wouldn't have somebody take that away from you. Although there is this, you know, when you, I feel like I saw a popular tweet going around the other day, like post whatever big electronics show there was, and they're like, these are the screen sizes that I saw at this event, and it was just epically long. So the point is, it's like, there's so many of those. They're like, how do you know where to put your multiple fixed width layouts, really? It's like, it's kind of nice working in the totally fluid version, knowing that because I've dealt with it in this completely fluid way, all of those will be covered perfectly fine.
I agree. For me, like the fixed width ones, like the top three breakpoints or whatever, you got iPhone, iPad, iMac or whatever. Those are your three websites.
Yeah.
I feel like it's, you create three websites and you're not embracing the fluidity of the web. You're trying to just be like, well, I just want it to do this. And that's okay. Like totally okay. But, no judgment zone. That's me from my heart of hearts. I'm not judging you on that. But what I just feel like I'm not like embracing how things work on the web. I'm still trying to slap some control and maybe that's good, but again, like you don't know what's good and what's bad. You know, maybe you design something super perfect for the iPad, you know, at 1024, but then the iPad mini comes out and it's like 80% smaller, you know, like you're like, it renders everything smaller. You don't know. And we can't control device manufacturers clearly. So, I say embrace fluidity the best you can. So.
Especially if you're like, if you're avoiding it on purpose or something, if you're like, if you're just like, oh, this is hard. I don't want to do it that way. And so you don't like, okay, but just admit that you're doing it that way and that, you know, just give it a shot sometime, maybe on a simpler project or on a rainy day or whatever. Try to see if you can get into it. Cause there is kind of like, it's a philosophical embracing of the fluidity of the world. I think you'll like it if you kind of get to that point.
Yep. All right. Well,
kaboom. Phil Thompson writes in, do you think there will ever be a day when the browser makers agree to standardize on how to do things like gradient backgrounds, et cetera, so that we could someday not have to worry about putting all the Blender prefixes in? Then for IE, change how we write it completely. if this day ever came, how big would the party be? So, Phil, just a little upset about browser inconsistencies and using prefixes. Where are we at in this world? Where is this still something that do you think the common developer still has woes about these days?
Yeah. So this question could be a little old. You know, let's say if it's 2 years old, I don't have a date on here, but like if it's 2 years old, like, yeah, it was pretty painful. Now it's getting a little easier. And now we have browsers like Blink and stuff saying they're not going to prefix things.
Yeah.
So
the world is getting a little better at it, wouldn't you say? And the tooling is getting better at the same time, I think. Exactly.
You love auto prefixer.
I do. Right? I do like that. And I guess we could talk about that for a moment. It's just kind of like you'd never even have to think about it. If you just spend the time to get a tool like auto prefixer into your workflow, you never even have to think about it. So forget about all this, you know, worry. I mean, that's your word, Phil. And you wouldn't have to worry if you just used a tool like vendor prefixer or auto prefixer that handles it for you. Is it because I've been using it for so long that I don't worry about it anymore and that not everybody has access to just use whatever build tools they want? So the people that don't have that access, it is still troublesome to them. Well, I think for you, it's, you know, it's true that the world is getting a little better that way. That if you hear news of vendor prefixes these days, it's almost always that one is being removed, not that a new one is being added. Because I think pretty much everybody has said, they've either said that we're not doing any more prefixes, or even though they haven't said it, they haven't actually done it. And maybe that's not entirely true. That's like kind of where it seems like it's happened.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still a little bit of prefixing, especially on the JavaScript end. You know, like if you ever want to do request animation frame, it's, you know, five lines of code to cover every browser or whatever.
Yeah, you're right. It's generally in the JavaScript world rather than the CSS world.
But I think CSS is going to get better. I mean, I think the CSS working group, they work painfully slow, but I feel like they have been kind of embarrassed by the whole thing and like the whole just moving too slow. So I feel like they're taking steps to move faster. For me, yeah, I've been thinking about cutting the mustard, you know, like how the BBC cuts the mustard, and it's like, and even then, and he mentions IE, and so that's where I'm thinking about it. You know, every time somebody mentions cut the mustard, they like ace IE8, you know, and that's still like on the support chart for me, like kind of, you know, so I'm just like, ah, that sucks, you know, but anyway, how big would this party be if everyone...
There won't be a party because it's too slow for that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would have said like what if everyone used the same rendering engine, you know? Like, would that be awesome?
That is a great discussion that should be a topic for a show. I feel not that we do topic shows, but if we did, it would be a cool one because it's like it solves all these immediate problems and it really is kind of party worthy. But then the other side of that coin is that the long term diversity is possibly what made the web as good as it is now. So like,
well, and you look at like Blink and WebKit, like Blink couldn't stand being a part of WebKit. You know, like, sure. Like there are breakups or whatever,
which actually forks. Kind of increases diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Or DRM.
Yo. All right, we better move on. All right. We got a long one. We got to settle in here and try to understand what Barry Maxwell's kind of where he's coming from, what he wants to build, what's going on here.
All right, here we go. Loading the audio.
Hi, guys. I'm a designer / front-end developer. My personal project is a surf report website. The site is built in WordPress. I need to take data from external sources, URLs, and reformat it to fit into my site design. It will resemble an app in functionality. And I do secure permission for the data when necessary. So my questions are, one, is CodeIgniter a good solution for learning the proper PHP way to import images and data from external sources? I will need to slice and format data before loading it. I'm using this as an excuse to learn some legitimate PHP skills. Two, what's the best way to do this without dozens of server requests for each site view? And three, I'm planning on just reformatting the data with CSS. I want to make some compelling infographics from the data. Recommendations?
All right.
Thanks.
All right. So question one, is CodeIgniter or something of that nature a good way to import images and data from external sources?
Well, yes. You know, because what sounds like what you're trying to build is an app. And CodeIgniter is like an app framework. So, you know, your surf report website, I mean, maybe someday you'll want user logins and stuff. And CodeIgniter is like a tool to kind of help you build that stuff. I'm sure it has kind of, you know, whatever its equivalent of gems are and stuff. There's probably people that have written common little components that you need for websites. Things like authentication. Surely there is one in CodeIgniter. If it doesn't come standard, there's some add-on for it. Probably there might even be add-ons for it to help you with third-party API stuff. But when you're talking about requesting data from an external source, it's through that third party's API probably. Mm-hmm. So they provide some kind of JSON or XML or something that has this surf report data in it, and you need to kind of ask for it. So can you do that in PHP? Absolutely. And just moving on to question number two, what's the best way to do this without dozens of server requests for each site view? I'm sure you're picturing a world in which that a page loads, the PHP on that page executes, and part of that execution is going out to ask this, you know, you know you need to display how big the waves are in Monterey, California. So you ask the API, what are the waves like in API in California? It returns some data and then you display it on your website. There's pretty much no world in which that's acceptable to ask a third-party API on every single page view of your site. There, at some yeah. point, you're going to have to figure out some kind of caching layer or like a
cache and stash.
Sure. What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, you're going to have to get that data and stuff it into a database at some point. You know, maybe you have a record for each surf spot, like Monterey or Mavericks or whatever, and you query for it once, like let's say on the first page load, right? Somebody accessing the site for the first time, you go get all the Monterey data, you come back, you stash that, and then you put it in your database. So you literally, you like, while you're about to serve it, you just say, hey, save a record or update the record for Monterey. Mm-hmm. Like,
You date stamp it too, so you know how old that piece of data is.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. And then, so when the second visitor comes, it's like you first check the date stamp, say, hey, is that date still fresh? And that's going to be a database query to you, but that'll be less painful than an API request. Mm-hmm.
API requests are painful to you, and they're painful to that other site. It's responsible in two different ways there, but go on.
Yeah, yeah. So you're like asking yourself, hey, is this fresh? If not, go get new stuff, you know. But, and that actually sucks for the user because they might have to do this really long chain. So what the ideal thing is, in the background, you get a cron job. That's a chronological job, maybe. That
or a queuing server or whatever. But it finds old data and it goes out and gets new data so that it doesn't happen on a user page load. It happens just
like in a background task.
Right. And something. This is programming, man. If you can pull this off, this is your... You can do anything.
Yeah.
You can do anything.
Yeah. Oh, you're pretty much, yeah, you're like, you're in startup city right there.
And we're done.
Oh, out of time. The last thing, CSS. Yes, all the way. Do it.
Okay.
Or Canvas. All right, bye.
Environments for Humans, our longtime sponsor, is doing Artifact Conf again. And I think they did the first one ever in Austin, Texas. And then it went so well that they went and did it in Providence, Rhode Island. And we talked about both of those things happening on the show. That's funny. And then it's funny when this timer runs out, it plays a YouTube video of a clock going off. It's just kind of funny. That it went so well that they're bringing it back to Austin. So the very next Artifact Conference is May 5th through 7th. So I know it's January now, or it's going on February when this comes out. So you really do only have a few months to think about this. Go to Austin in May is the point. You'll love it if you've never been there. Hometown of Dave Rupert.
Hey. I will be there.
Yeah. So that'll be cool. Okay, look at all these people that are going to be at it. People that have been on Shop Talk before: Jeremy Keith, Brad Frost, Val Head. People that haven't been on Shop Talk, but we desperately need to get on Shop Talk: Todd Parker, Eileen Webb, Stephen Hay. It's an awesome lineup. It's an in-person one, and it's in beautiful Austin. So there'll be like outdoor activities, probably some like drinking on wooden surfaces and stuff. That's what I think of Austin as.
Drinking on wooden surfaces. Perfect. We got okay. it. That's it.
Let that me just read. Our Artifact's mission is to educate designers on emerging practices for across device web design and foster and sense cooperation in the community. We provide as many practical takeaways as possible, topped off with a layer of inspiration. So lovely. That's what you're going to get on going to Artifact Conference. Should be a good time. Thanks for the sponsorship. That's artifactconf.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Artifact. You guys are great. And I will be hanging out there. I will be trolling people. Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm speaking or not, but maybe we'll see. Hometown. All right, here we go. I think as a hometown guy, I can just walk up on stage at any point. I think that's the rule.
I think so.
All right. Next question comes from Brandon Shaw. Are there any really good introductions to CSS preprocessors? Not just the syntax and features, but how to actually install locally both Windows and Mac, and how to incorporate them into real world workflow. I've been looking around the web and feel like I've missed something. I've been programming both front end, back end, and consider myself to be fairly savvy. So I'm disappointed I'm not on this wagon yet. And again, disclaimer, this question could be a little old, but sure. Maybe Brandon does know, but it's still relevant. Here we go.
Yeah.
Chris, do you know of any good resources? I'm trying to think in my head.
Well, I know that the SAS website has redesigned itself. So there's better, nicer, easier to follow documentation there. So if for instance, you're interested in SAS, there'll be some instructions there about how to install it. So Brandon's question is interesting, right? It's not like, should I use them? What do they mean to the world? Kind of stuff that we normally address here. It's the nuts and bolts, like literally, how do I get this working on my computer? And most of them are kind of like command line tools at their root. And then if you use some kind of UI over them or some kind of build press over them, that's just essentially calling out to this otherwise command line tool to do it for you, to kind of help you out in that way. But at a root, SAS is a Ruby project. And I know, you know, we could go off on what that means and the alternatives to that or whatever, but it's this, you have to have Ruby running on your machine, and then you download Ruby, and then it gives you this kind of ability to process a single SAS file. So you can, you know, kind of compile it at a time. And then, oh gosh, I feel like I'm going off and ruining this, but there's just some instructions that you can follow to install the dependencies and install it. So we can point you to those in the show notes, but There's also, you could follow my my article on 24 ways about Grunt, because one of Grunt's abilities is to run these little tasks. So that would be like leveling up one level from that, is to, I don't know, do it the Grunt way. I don't know. I feel like I'm not doing a very good job on this. Can you take it away from me? How do you actually install a preprocessor?
I mean, yeah, like, so there's the command line route. And if you work on a team of all developers, you know, backend developers, like, that might be really easy to get them involved. If you work on a team with mostly designers, no knock against designers, but that's maybe a little harder to get everyone on board. That's where you want to use these GUIs, like graphical user interfaces, like Preprocess or CodeKit or whatever. You want to just get them using something that they can just point at their website. As far as something that like teaches it really well, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure there's like a code school or a or you know, Treehouse or something that does that, but that might be tough to onboard your whole company to. But I mean, I feel like it's one of those things where maybe Rockstar driven development, where one person just has to kind of do it and like demonstrate the benefits, and that gets everyone else kind of psyched and stoked and start participating. I know that's what happened at Dribbble, right? Rich Thornett.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm using this and Dan Cederholm, you have to learn it. And then Dan Cederholm writes a book about it. So,
right. Pretty, classic story. Know. Everybody has a story like that. I mean, that one plays out really in a nice way to, oops, we're over. But that's the, you could, Brandon, you can find instructions. But
I would, I bet that Dan book is really good. A book apart.
Good point.
But anyway. All right. Hey, well, we got another audio question. I'm very excited about it. It's from Augustine Amenabar. And let's load it up. Here we go.
Hello, guys. Been listening to the show for a while. A lot of fun. Okay, my question is, well, I'm assuming we've all heard and worked with HTML5 boilerplate. The thing is, how can you keep up with it? It's constantly changing. I mean, straight out of the box is painful. So even with the build script, I even made my own boilerplate based on the original one, but it became outdated very fast. So how do you do it? How do you get, do you build your own boilerplate and just use it on every project for, I don't know, 6 months and then update it, or constantly updating it? I don't know. Tell us your magic, please. Thanks. Bye.
All right. So how do you keep boilerplate H5BP, as I like to call it, updated?
I'm going to click the button here. It is an interesting question, because something like, let's say you're using jQuery to update jQuery, you just do it and then you link to the new version instead of the old version. But boilerplate isn't like that. It's not a single dependency that you just like link to from another project. It's like the core of your templates and stuff. Right. So when it updates, it's not as simple as just replacing that file. It's more insidious than that. You know, it's kind of touches a bunch of different things. So how do you think about that issue, Dave?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? Like if you look at HTML5 boilerplate on GitHub right now, as of today, there's been 1,295 commits. So if you download it on day one, you are behind a whole bunch, right? So, you know, if you want to like take it down a step, you could like go by tags. They have tags for each of their branches, like release versions, you know, version 4.3 is the current one I'm looking at here. So, you know, so maybe you like go from your release date, like you just update from the release date, and you can kind of probably use GitHub to compare and contrast those two, like what changed. My thing, I think, is that boilerplate is not a dependency, and that's maybe where the confusion comes in. It can be used to generate a site really quick with like Yeoman or something like that, but more or less it was built to be a starting point for HTML5, and that was kind of the spirit of it. And they added a bunch of features, and then I think recently they took a bunch of features out because they were just like, this is just not crucial to HTML5. Like they took out the image replacement stuff and it's just interesting. I think the idea is that you have the boilerplate you get, and that's where you start, It's not a finished
product. Yeah, it's not that big of a deal if you are missing a few things from the very latest release, probably. But one of the ways you could check is just go look at the commits, see what lines of mm-hmm. code changes and be like, oh, dang, that's good. I'm going to steal that. And then go put that little line in there. And as a matter of fact, that's how a lot of us use HTML boilerplate, period. Is not just to actually grab it and actually start with it, but look through all the best practices that are presented in such a clear way there and go steal little lines from it.
Yeah, I cherry pick lines. I mean, like, heck. I mean, even like, you know how it used to have that Paul Irish one, the like all the IEs up at the top, you mm-hmm. know? They've reverted that to just being doctype HTML.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Because they're just thinking it's too presumptuous that you would want to do something special for those old.
Yeah, maybe they're IE9 plus now, you know, or maybe they're just like, if you're doing something there, you could do it on the server and just inject that, you know.
Yeah.
Or they also advocate using whatever Chrome frame or something. Dong. Anyway, don't worry about it. Just keep going. Keep pushing forward and circle back around. Right?
Good point.
Okay.
Let's see. Mark. Now that Retina is officially coming to the laptop experience, again, we were picking some old questions here, but you could replace that in your head with 4K if you wanted to. I am embracing myself for dealing with having to output design and development mockups at twice the resolution. You know, how has that, that's kind of what happened to us, right? As Retina came along, we're like, oh crap, we apparently to make images look really good, they have to be twice as big now. Or do they? Anyway, he goes on to say, I'm already finding myself outputting 2x resolution for iPhone, iPad, iPad mockups. I'm wondering, how do you guys streamline production when taking in, when thinking about differing scale resolutions?
This is tough.
It is. There's a couple of questions here. There's like kind of the like the what's the responsible thing to do, especially that this problem is really getting to be a big problem. I mean, if you have a picture of a hamburger on a blog, it's getting to the point where like, I don't know. You want, of course, everybody's still thinking about desktop because desktop is still big. To have this picture that's literally like 8,000 pixels wide is not, it's not just like teetering on not okay anymore. It's straight up not okay to serve that to a phone. It's just enormously yeah. big, which is, it's difficult for the browser to scale it down. It's way too much data to be sending over the wire. I think there was an interesting thing that you tweeted the other day, right? About the average image weight of websites is going crazy. It's
1 meg right now.
Yeah, so, it has the same growth rate as like Americans' waistlines.
What?
Waka 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 waka. Hey,
thank you. Thanks, waka, everybody. Waka. Thank you. Thanks. Waka, waka. Thanks a lot.
Hey. Yeah. I mean, so we're.
So one question is so the responsibility.
When this question came in, this was clearly like Retina laptops, MacBook Pro, the Chromebook Pixel, yeah. and probably the, I think the MS Surface is a 1.5 or whatever. So like all of these laptops and stuff are going high end on their screens. And so now we need high end assets. And, I just posted recently, about 4K because that was a big deal at CES. And there's going to be a bunch of like, $600 to $800 4K monitors.
There's a $500
desktop. Yeah. And we're talking 28 to 32 inch desktop screens that are 3,800 pixels wide. I mean, dude, it's getting crazy. And if you run at 3,800 pixels, it's probably because you like enjoy multiple windows on your page, you know? So we could maybe like taper that use case, but like I'm actually looking at it from like a 1X 1920 by 1080, 1080. Mm-hmm. HD or whatever, a 2x 1080 resolution. And, you know, just so, cause I spend my whole day reading and I want that Retina type that is just very crisp and clear reading experience. So, I mean, that's where it's getting very, very confusing to me. So I think the big deal here is like, how are we going to do it? I think, you know, I come back to my Mo Pixels, Mo Problems article on Alyssa Part, which was, you know,
yeah.
Use CSS and SVG and icon fonts and
yes.
and try to use anything that does not have
like
an
avoid
image.
Raster like, at raster at all costs. And then if you have to use raster, just like you don't necessarily need 2x, maybe you can even 1.25x it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of a hack too. I think we experimented with that on CodePen a long time ago before I was writing that article. I was like, oh, Chris has a Retina MacBook Pro. How's this look? And I sent you like a 1, a 2, and a 1.5x image. And you're like, the 1.5 is a little janky, but it passes or whatever. So, that's something to think about. I think if you're in the thing where you're like mocking in Photoshop, you know, and you're like just slicing the Photoshop document out, that's going to be painful. I mean, right?
Absolutely.
That's like,
I wouldn't think about the math. So, I mean, I never do. I just, if I know I need an image to look good on Retina, I just make it some bigger. I don't even think about it all that much. But that's the second question here, kind of, is that how do you manage the kind of production of that? You need 2X or 4X assets or whatever the heck. How do you, keep that stuff around so that you can handle that? And I would say, well, just keep the biggest one around, you know, and then have it.
I mean,
have some naming convention that you use for. I mean, if all you're doing is scaling it down, all you got to do is keep the biggest one, because you can always just change the image size and resave it and save out a smaller version of that. If there's some art direction involved, then have a naming convention that is that resource dash, and then name it something: alpha, beta, gamma, mama bear, papa bear, baby bear, whatever. That's what I do. And in fact, I just did this recently in our little CodePen hello page. It's kind of a marketing page, and there's a lot of images on it. And I tried to do it as responsibly as I could. And that, it uses the picture thing, picture fill. And it, you know, it starts with the lowest resolution thing. And I needed art direction because there's some images on there that are just too big. They just are meaningless if viewed really small. So I have a totally different version of them. So I have different PSDs for all of the different sizes, that where I can literally have different things. And I have a naming convention that is how I store those files, and it seemed to work okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's it, is you just have to maybe start at 2X, just like you would if you're designing an iPhone app. You know, most people don't even worry about the like 1X phones. They just set it and forget it, or like run it through a cruncher or something like that. So, I mean, I think we're just going to have to kind of start designing at bigger resolutions and kind of break up with the idea that what I design in Photoshop looks exactly what the final product is. So, did we use a card there? I think we used a card.
I did. I forgot to hit the button. So we can use mine. I talked longer.
All right.
Shrikanth
AD.
You're good at this. As it basically says, which grid system do you prefer? And then lists out the 1140 grid pixel, skeleton, and foundation. And those are certainly not the only three in the block. Suzy is a big popular one if you want to get preprocessors involved. And who knows, what other ones pop into your mind that aren't in this list?
Bourbon Neat is my favorite one right now. So I'm going to actually not pick any of yours, Shrikanth. I'm going to pick Bourbon Neat.
Nice. And was I right? Is Suzy a grid framework? I think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yeah. I regret. If I could go back in time, I think I would have picked one, and I probably would pick a sassy one, and I would get on board sooner. Because at the moment, and I have an article called Don't Overthink It Grids, and I'm not trying to turn my back on that. I think that's smart and has worked for me for a long, long time here. But what it's not is it's kind of just saying grids aren't that hard. Just kind of make one up and then use it. But it is work each time, you know, to think about it. I think that I like the idea of having picked a really good, solid grid framework and then just use it on everything. I think that would have saved me time. I think it would have been more robust. So I'm starting to get on board with that. And I haven't yet, but I kind of plan to kind of pick one of these things. And maybe I will pick Bourbon Neat, although I'm not sure if I care for the bourbon dependency, just because, I don't know, I'm using auto prefixer and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I need to double check if it has a dependency. I'll do that today.
It might not, because why does a grid framework necessarily need vendor prefixing, and why, and can't you just say, hey, I don't need that, I'm going to use something else for vendor prefixing?
Unless there's a mix-in. One little mix-in.
Right, and then it's a dependency, and then it's all over. But surely it could be ported. Maybe I'd even do it. I'm not afraid of some work.
Work. I try to avoid it. But yeah, I think, I mean, all of these are good. Skeleton has that like adaptive thing that we kind of mentioned before. Foundation is awesome. It's a really smart grid system. But it also is like heaps and heaps of widgets and components and that can be awesome or that can kind of pigeonhole you in your design. So, it depends on your team sort of thing. If all those components they have kind of prepackaged and designed and set up for you kind of work for you, then it's awesome. So, but if like you kind of have petty differences, maybe it's not awesome. So there you go. I would look into Foundation out of those choices. All right. Next question is an audio question. Our favorite kind of questions from Fardim Munir, who is 12 years old. This is awesome. Thanks, Fardim. He's maybe 15 now. But let's check it out. It's about responsive websites. It's a little long, but we're going to get through it. Here we go.
Hey, guys. My name is Fardim Munir, and I'm from Bangladesh here. I have to tell that it's an awesome podcast, the best one about front-end development around in the internet. And my question I like to ask ShopTalk is rather foolish, I have to say, because I'm very young and I am doing front-end development for only about 6 months. So my question is that how do you center a responsive website? I tried with Xero and Otter, but that did not work. Until I had mentioned that the width was 1200 pixel, then the site got centered. But I don't want to mention the pixel because, as I told, it's a responsive website. So how do I do it? Thanks.
Well, awesome. Thanks, Fardim, for writing in. And it's awesome to know we are the top podcast in Bangladesh. So, and you're, dude, right. You're killing it on your English stuff. So here we go.
He's got a good point, right? That if you go margin zero auto and you don't mention a width on a div, say, the div will behave like it has width 100%, kind of, right? It just will naturally expand all the way to as wide as that div will be. So if you have a website and it's wrapped in a div, or even if it's just the body element, it will just be as wide as the world is. So margin zero auto doesn't do anything, right?
Mm-hmm. No, because it's like 100%. So,
but you're saying you want to center your website. So you have in your mind that your website isn't as wide as the entire browser window. It's somehow narrower than that.
1200 pixels, I think he says.
Yeah, he said he used 1200 pixels and then it started to work, right? Which it would.
Yeah.
Because then the zero and the auto part of margin means like, zero, if you just use zero auto, it means auto for the left and the right and zero for the bottom and the top. And auto means take whatever it would be and kind of the margin and kind of divide it in half or put equal margins on either side of it. So now let's say your browser window is 1400 pixels wide. You've said you want the width of this div to be 1200 pixels wide. You will put a margin of 100 on either side of that div. So, but what you're saying is you want it to be responsive though. You don't want to say width equals 1200 pixels because that's too specific. You're trying to make yours flexible. Well, if you have in mind that your website is narrower than the entire browser window, or at least it is in certain situations, then just don't use pixels, use percentages, Fardim. Use something like width equals 80%. That way it will still be flexible with the browser window, but it will be centered or will have that centered look that I think is kind of what's in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really weird, but yeah, I usually like set a site container, right? Like a wrapper div on my whole website that is max width 1200 pixels, and then
or max width. That's a great point that I totally didn't mention.
Yeah, like or width, you know, width 80%. Mm-hmm. You know, and then margin zero auto will center that in 80%, and it'll auto calculate the whatchamacallit, the like 10% on each side, and it's pretty awesome. But max width, you know, that's where you just like kind of lock it up and you're like, I'm done at this point. I quit doing websites. So, I quit making this bigger. So
max width is a kind of a good way to do it. I would say that that's a pretty normal way these days, because with 80% on like a phone in portrait mode, there's just like too much being eaten up by the outsides and whatever. Generally, you have a wrapper not have any extra padding around the outside of it at really small screen sizes. So just doing a maximum width is nice because it solves two things at once. It solves that if it doesn't get too ridiculously wide to the point where line lengths are unreadably long and the website just looks awkward that way. And it solves that when it gets narrower than that, there's no additional space on the outside. So max width is generally a good way to go about it.
Yeah. And this is where you want to test on devices, because people get these like rails wrong, right? Like I call them the rails on your content on the phone. You know, sometimes it's like this person has like 5 words, you know, per line on their blog, and it's actually terrible to read on a phone. So that's where you want to kind of keep a eye out for it. And ciao. Next question.
Let's just do one more and wrap it up if we could.
Here we go.
Gavin Steele. Do you want to read it?
Here we go. Gavin Steele writes in, what effect is the template market having on young developers who are trying to go it alone? Is it lowering cost client expectations but raising their deliverable requirement? Good question. So are templates, whatever, you know, those sites, are they killing web design for young developers? Chris?
Okay. I mean, I think you're going to have some stuff to say about this, because you said you just had a conversation about it with somebody, which is interesting. I'd like to know how that went. But it was kind of like, I don't know, templates are cheap, right? You can go find a really nice template on all kinds of different websites that kind of handle different needs, from very generic and nice looking to very niche. Like, here's a dentist website. It's right here. It has a beautiful looking tooth on it. And you can get it for, let's say, $25 or something. You download it, you upload it to a server, you change, you know, general dentist website to South Memphis dentist or whatever. And then, you know, then you charge $1,000 for it or whatever. Is that ruining the world of design, or are really good designers still okay in the world? And the market that this is decimating is the smaller, you know, agencies and the young developers. Does it hurt them specifically?
I think it might, but here's my like general opinion on it, is like, you get what you pay for. And here's what I'm saying is, like, templates may cost $25 and they, you know, in like, they look good. They look better than maybe I can do in 100 hours, you know? But I still feel like, you know, you can tell clients or whatever, it's like, yeah, I can get you a $25 website, but like, you need to know what to do with it. My accountant has a $25 template that looks awesome, but all the pages are lorem ipsum beneath the homepage. So you click on accounting services and it is lorem ipsum. And it's like the like care that goes into it is zero. So it's kind of like they're getting what they paid for. Like, I will not go with them for bookkeeping, because clearly they don't offer it. They just offer stock text.
Right.
So that's where the value comes in. You have to provide more value than these services. You know, it's the same with like, is macaw killing web design? It's like, well, maybe, but you just have to provide more than macaw provides, you know, which is the ideas, the what makes a good website, all that UX experience and stuff.
Yes,
that's what you provide.
Exactly. That's what I love to hear, that like kind of that, I don't know, there's more to this than a template. And even if even the template takes some skill to customize and deliver, like, and it's more important is how you walk them through it, how you make them feel, how you are going to solve their problems for them, how you, you know, bringing your all the rest of your experience, not just the very specific technical stuff of using a template.
And so, yeah, you provide more service than that. So I would not worry about that. So here's my anecdote, right, that you were mentioning earlier, Chris, is, and I'm going to use my card to tell my story. I was like, at a meetup recently, and, my friend was like, yeah, I just put in my 2 weeks. And I was like, cool, what are you going to do? And he's like, oh, I'm going to go out and, I'm going to do some, private WordPress themes. I'm going to work on some themes and release those. And then, you know, if I need to, I'll take up some client work. And historically, I've thought of like theme work as like, good luck, chump. Like, like that's, if selling things at $25, that's, you got to sell a lot of things for $25 to like be able to eat anything other than ramen, you know?
Yeah.
And then somebody's taking a 30% cut. So I was just like, yeah, well, that seems rough. But then he was kind of like saying like, he knows people who are, you know, with their support and with their help and stuff like that, they're pulling like 50 grand a month down and stuff like that.
I believe it. I think that WordPress theme business is big business. I think people buy the crap out of those things.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, that's crazy. But I mean, you know, I also think like you could start a business being a dude who knows a lot about WordPress templates and then like, whatever, like upselling that, you know, like it's like, yeah, I know every single template on the market, all 1 million of them, and I'll get you the best one for your business and I'll build it out for you and populate all the content. I feel like that could be a job, you know, or develop custom components for that theme. I mean, you know, there are like Genesis developers out there, you know, which is crazy. Like, and that's a WordPress theme framework. It's wild. So I'm just saying there's a market, like, I don't think it kills. If anything, it provides you great opportunity. Ha! There.
Ha!
Soundbited that, mother.
I agree with everything Dave just said.
Excellent!
Don't worry about it.
What were you saying? Don't worry about it?
No, I agree with mostly you said. Yeah. I mean, don't worry about it too hard. I mean, I don't know. It's rough to be, oh, woe is me about something like that. Like, I'm not going to get into web development. The market is ruined. Like, come on. No, it isn't. It's killing it. It's doing amazing.
Right. Well, like if you were sitting around talking with somebody and they're like, well, why should I pay you? Let's say this is super cheap. Hashtag this is super cheap. Why should I pay you $300 when I can get a template for $25 or whatever? You know, you need to say like, well, you can do that, but I know how to install it. I'm really good at like content and making sure that your message is perceived, and somebody's going to be like, oh, really? So, you know, or you just say like, have you ever been to a bad website? The chances are that was just a template with no thought behind it. And that's, I feel like you could sell that, you know, you could sell him the template and your services and like get both, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Gavin, hopefully that helps you in your quest. Chris.
Indeed. Thanks everybody for listening to our rapid fire show. We will continue to do these anytime. To be perfectly honest, we oftentimes shoot them ahead of time when we have a week that me and Dave are traveling, and there's going to be a number of those coming up. So look forward to more rapid fires, and we will talk to you next time.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.